Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Hope everyone had a great weekend. I know I was working at the hospital. It was very, very busy. Just glad to be with you on this Monday morning. We're at a different time this morning. We had some technical issues to sort out because usually I'm here at 9:30 Central Standard Time, but it's 11 a.m. But things are looking much better, and we have an important program, as always, for you today. It is really a nice day here in Florissant. We've been through the cold Arctic weather for the last 4 or 5 days, and guess what? Just about 3 weeks from today, it'll be the official start of spring, and in about a week and a half or so, we have the time change. So spring is in the air, and I can't wait. Just looking forward to some great, great times, grilling on the deck, outside in the backyard with the dog, just having a good time. I hate the frigid cold. Just not something that I enjoy at all. I want to talk to you this morning about several issues, but I want to start with the news in Iran, because this is a program speaking hope and freedom to Iran. It was about a year ago that I published my 12th self-published book. And it was a groundbreaking book. It was the story of a young Iranian woman named Rehane Jabari, who spent 7 agonizing years in prison in Iran, tortured, interrogated, and finally hanged. Her crime? She defended herself against a government rapist. She stabbed him, and as a result, he died. All too often in Iran, you will hear the story, the heartbreaking story of young Iranian women committing suicide. A lot of it has to do with the male domination, the oppression of that culture, the hopelessness that's there. But some of it has to do with a situation like Rehane. In fact, it was just right after her execution in October of 2014, May of the next year, there was a young hotel clerk. It was a young Iranian girl named Farazani. I think her name was Farazan. She leapt to her death from a hotel balcony. And the crowd, when they found out what happened to this young woman, just rebelled. They start throwing things at the motel or the hotel. They began a riot. And the reason why this young girl leapt to her death was that she was sexually abused by a member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. She was raped. And she leapt to her death. Why? Well, let me tell you another story. Just recently, Mahdas Ghavami, a young female engineer, was summoned to the Ministry of Intelligence in Kermanshah. You go to the Ministry of Intelligence when the government suspects you of speaking out, of protesting, of being critical of Islam or the Iranian regime. I don't know the circumstances of why she was made to go there. It could have been that she had a Facebook page, didn't have proper hijab, she had said something critical of the government, I'm not sure. But when she was there, detained by the Ministry of Intelligence, Mahdas was sexually abused. When she was released, she committed suicide. She took aluminum phosphate tablets. They are poison. She killed herself. Her parents were forbidden by the intelligence agents for saying anything about her death or suicide. Yet they courageously have made known her story. In the case of Rahane and Farazani and Mahdas, all three were raped. All three were in a situation where rape in Iran is a bad thing for a woman. Rahane was interrogated and tortured and told, you must change your story, and if you do, you might live. And Rahane refused to dishonor herself and tell a lie. She was raped by a former intelligence agent. As a result, she was hanged on October 25th, 2015. Mahdas and Farazani, I'm sure, knew about Rahane and what happened to her as a result of standing firm and refusing to deny she was raped. And they took their own lives because they didn't want to suffer what Rahane suffered. And I'm sure that had something to do with it. A woman who was raped in Iran, who is the innocent victim of the sexual advances of these evil intelligence ogres, have no hope. If they try to claim, I've been raped, they will be told it's your fault, something you did to attract the man. They will be interrogated and tortured and finally killed, like Rahane. In the case of Farazani and Mahdas here, this is why they do this. These are the women that I speak up for every day on this program. These are the women I write books about because their stories need to be told. And when I have a situation like listening to the protests of a woman's rally just a month ago, talking about the so-called rights that are being denied women here, I want to scream with outrage. Why weren't you there to speak up for Rahane? Why weren't you there to speak up for Farazani or Mahdas? Where's your voice for these women? There is no voice for them. So you have the Hollywood elite at the Oscars last night criticizing President Trump over his immigration policies. But where is their voice? Where is their outrage for the women in Iran that suffer every day? There is no voice by the Hollywood elite. And who needs them? Who cares about what they say? So I tell you the story of Mahdas today, of Farazani, and Rahane, because these women in Iran are the number one passion of my life. They need a voice. They need someone to speak up and to protest the way they are treated. And so one day, maybe I will write Modest a story, and maybe one day this, I will tell you a little secret. I can't go into detail, but one day there may be a film in the making that puts Iranian women and their stories out all over the world. I will only tell you that much. There is something in the making behind the scenes. We are going to do something different. We are tired of the media and the culture. Some friends of mine and myself are going to do something pretty extraordinary. We're going to do what this media and this culture refuses to do. We don't need them. We will do it ourselves. So just keep that in mind. Maybe in the next couple of years you might see something groundbreaking that will put the stories of these Iranian women on film all over the world. I want to also talk to you about the issue of a letter and an investigation Iranian dissidents are making about the Islamic regime's secret U.S. lobbying network here. A group of nearly 100 prominent Iranian dissidents are demanding that Congress launch investigations into clandestine efforts by the Islamic Republic to influence U.S. policy using a network of lobbyists and propaganda pieces placed in the Voice of America's Persian service. And this is a letter that was obtained and sent to leading lawmakers, and it was obtained by the Washington Free Beacon. The group of dissidents are composed of prominent Iranian voices that oppose the hardline regime in Tehran, and they're complaining that Congress is not doing enough to expose their lobbying efforts here in the United States, and they're using voice of media like Voice of America Persian. Now, they claim that Voice of America has been infiltrated by Iranian regime loyalists who seek to spin coverage in a favorable way for Tehran. In one instance, an Iranian dissident was banned from appearing on Voice of America simply because he had a critical opinion different than theirs about the regime. Now, this letter to President Trump is coming at a time when this administration is cracking down on Iran and the way they have violated their nuclear treaty. The letter has been sent to Senator Bob Corker. He's a representative of Tennessee, Representative Ed Royce from California. The heads of Congresses and the Foreign Affairs Committees have gotten copies of this letter, which was obtained by the Free Beacon. The dissidents write, "We ask that you launch an investigation into any and all lobbying activities of Iranian-American groups which ostensibly promote the interests of our community, but whose real goal is to undermine long-term U.S. national security interests in Iran and its neighborhood." Now, here's what they're citing, these dissidents, in the letter. Organizations such as the National Iranian American Council, or NIAC, right here in Washington, has played a key role in championing the Iran nuclear agreement and many other things. They've worked closely with the Obama administration, and they have always been under suspicion. NIAC has served as a mouthpiece for the Iranian regime here in the United States. Now, these group of dissidents, there are many different roles they play. They're policy experts, they're university professors, they're interfaith leaders, they're real estate developers, they're human rights activists, and they are requesting that Congress shine a light on NIAC and Voice of America. And I compliment them for their courage because just a few months ago, the Iranian regime announced, if you will, that members of the Iran National Guard were going to perform assassinations abroad on those Iranian dissidents who are critical of the Iran government in other countries. And so these dissidents are risking their own lives, but they're unafraid and unashamed to say we need to do something about these lobbyists here in Washington. So please, please be in prayer for them as they put their lives on the line, but they are doing what they can do to stop the lobbyists here in the United States from filtering the news, spinning the news favorably toward the hardliners in Iran. I want to turn our attention now to the immigration issue. Just about a week ago, when Donald Trump, President Trump, was in Florida, he talked about Sweden and the horrible situation there with immigration. And he basically was saying, this is what our country can look like if we don't take drastic measures right now with the executive ban on those countries that sponsor terrorism. And we can't allow these people to come into our country until they are absolutely thoroughly vetted. And so Sweden, when you look at it, kind of an example of what our nation will look like if we open up our borders without discrimination and embrace multiculturalism. Look what happens in Sweden. Well, there are those. Even some of my Facebook friends, they say, oh, there's some vandalism going on. It has nothing to do with the immigrants. Really? I want you to hear this special report right now from Ami Horowitz on the Tucker Carlson program as he describes in a film he made about Sweden immigration. Let's listen right now in The Cross in the Desert.
Muslim countries, perhaps no nation on earth is more committed to accepting foreign migrants and refugees than Sweden. 2016 alone, the country accepted more than 160,000 asylum seekers, despite having a population of less than 10 million people. Only 500 of these migrants were able to get jobs in Sweden. But if these arrivals aren't able to work, they're at least able to commit crimes, quite a few of them, in fact. Ami Horowitz is a filmmaker. He went to Sweden to chronicle its refugee experience. Here's a short clip of what he found.
Did you see the violence really spreading across Sweden into the cities?
At least one or two times a week.
And let's say 5 years ago, how often would you say it was?
Three times a year.
Really? The increase in this kind of crime is exponential.
I think we caught off guard. We didn't expect it to be so much increase.
Tucker spoke with the filmmaker earlier this week.
Ami, thanks a lot for coming on. So before you describe what you saw there, give us the overview. What is the justification within Sweden for importing this many migrants from other countries? Why are they doing it?
Well, in Sweden's own words, they consider themselves to be a humanitarian superpower, probably the only superpower that they would qualify for. So they feel that it's their moral duty to open their borders to all and any refugees that want to come to them.
So you've recently spent time there. Tell me if I'm overstating this. I don't think many people in Sweden think this is working well. Is that fair to say?
No, it's not fair to say, actually. In fact, most people that you ask about the refugee crisis, they will say, because the reason why I did the whole thing to begin with, taking a step back, was that there was an absolute surge in both gun violence and rape in Sweden once they began this open-door policy. So they know that this crime is happening. They can feel it. The statistics are clear. But they would refer to what is the root cause behind it and say, oh, it's just more, it happens to be more violence. It's men who are raping people, not the refugees. They'll make excuses for it. The majority of the population in Sweden still want to have an open door policy. It's confounding.
Huh, that's remarkable. Now, the statistics on the crime rise that you just referred to, there have been reports in the American press that those statistics are either closely held by the Swedish authorities or they've been manipulated by the Swedish authorities to downplay the role of migrants in those crimes. Is that true?
Well, it depends. The crime statistics are the crime statistics, and they're not closely held. They're open to the public, and they do show this incredible surge of violence. What may actually be the problem is that they oftentimes try to cover up some of these crimes. That, for example, there's been a rash of these rapes, these music festivals. And what happens is they cover up as far as they could who the perpetrators were or if actually rapes had actually occurred. Now, obviously, when you have so many people witnessing these rapes, they're difficult to do and they've come out to the public. But I think that's kind of what they're referring to, that the government has gone out of its way to try to cover up some of these problems.
That is grotesque. So to the job numbers, we had in the intro something like 160,000 asylum seekers, only 500 wound up working in Sweden. That leaves a lot of unemployed people. What are they doing and how are they living?
Oh, they live great, Tucker. I mean, it's one of the most generous, financial programs that they have in terms of the amount of money they're giving to them, the housing benefits they get, the education benefits they get, the cash benefits they get. So they have these, and what they really become are no-go zones. These are areas that cops won't even enter because it's too dangerous for them. This is the policy of the National Police Authority in Sweden. So they live in these enclaves, which, by the way, are lovely. They're leafy neighborhoods. They're beautiful apartments. And they are sitting around. You're right. It's difficult to get jobs. There's too many of them. But they have tremendous benefits there, which is why so many of these migrants are going to Sweden to begin with.
We know that the masochism of the West really knows no bounds at all. So I believe you when you say that it's not often people say out loud, I'm dissatisfied with this arrangement. I know Swedes, though, who at least in private will say this is a disaster. What's the social sanction for saying that out loud? Can you just say, you know, this isn't working, or do people come down on you for saying something like that?
Oh, you can say it, but you're a racist. You're a xenophobe, right? You're Islamophobe. When I was out there, I remember I was at this kind of swanky party in Stockholm, and I started discussing what I was doing there, and the entire party kind of gathered around me and started yelling at me that all those things. I'm a xenophobe. I'm a racist. I'm anti-Islamic. Even though the statistics were clear about who's the perperpetrators, it doesn't make a difference. It's very socially unacceptable to make these kind of claims.
Right, because the most important thing is to feel virtuous, I guess. Ami Horowitz, that's amazing. One last question, I can't resist. What's the long game here? How is this going to look 10 or 15 years from now? Does it seem like assimilation is taking place?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, we don't have to actually prognosticate on what the long game is. You can look at France and Belgium, because they've been doing it for that period of time for longer. And you can see the social unrest that's going on there, the terrorism that's happening there. Sweden, this is a relatively new policy, a phenomenon for them. And by the way, Sweden had its first terrorist Islamic attack not that long ago. So they're now getting the taste of what we've been seeing across Europe already.
Sad. Thanks a lot for joining us. Ami Horowitz. Appreciate it.
That's Jarkko Carlson and Ami Horowitz, and what Ami is saying is absolutely true. The government there and the police there went to downplay what's going on. They went to offer an alternative scenario. Oh, these are just, you know, hoodlums and criminals. They're not really the immigrants, and they do their best to keep the multiculturalism coming because it's big dollars, you know. Immigration is big dollars for the government in many ways, you know, just like it would be here. So the situation is this. The government is doing its best to downplay it to the media. And in the media, if you dare to criticize what's going on in Sweden or Germany or Belgium or any of these countries, you are immediately shut down with Islamophobia, or you're a racist, and really it's sidestepping the whole fiasco, what's going on here. Well, let's be clear. The United States is an immigrant nation. It's a nation of pioneers, but these immigrants come in legally. They are properly vetted. They assimilate into our culture. In Sweden, it's the actual opposite. They're not properly vetted in many ways. They don't assimilate, and they vandalize. They rape. This is what Europe looks like, and I think that President Trump is absolutely 100% correct with his immigration ban. And hopefully this executive order that has been reissued will easily pass through, simply because when you look at Sweden and Europe and you ask yourself this very simple question, is that a picture of us one day? And I would say frighteningly, yes, it is. And unless we take drastic measures to prevent that, we will be in the same situation. I don't know how you could look at that and not come to that conclusion. And how you could say, oh, well, you know, there's crime everywhere. This is the picture of life under multiculturalism. It is political correctness at its best. Political correctness will destroy this nation unless we take an aggressive stand. And so, for those of you who still think that Donald Trump, President Trump, is somehow a racist or anti-Muslim, remember very simply this. The countries that he is banning are those on the same list that dear President Barack Obama had at one time. At one time, President Barack Obama refused to allow Iraqi refugees in because of some terrorist threats. So why wasn't there such an outrage then like there is now. It's pretty simple to me. The left hates Donald Trump. They're going to do everything they can to delegitimize him. And so goes the immigration policy. But thank God for President Trump, who cares enough for our national security and our safety to implement this ban for our good. When he said he would make America great again, he wasn't lying. He wasn't kidding. He has kept his promises. So I would just simply say, when you listen to a report in Sweden, in Denmark, in Germany, in France, and when you see the video and the pictures of the result of allowing improperly vetted immigrants in, and you hear the stories of rape and violence, I don't know how you can put your hands over your eyes and in multiculturalism sing kumbaya and everything is fine, because it's not. It's dangerous. And I am thankful we have a president for the first time in 8 years that has actually cared about our country, that has cared about its people, that wants to uphold the law. Duh, that's the thing wrong with the left. They have a disregard for the law. And this is the problem that you will encounter when you vote for people like them. Thank God this is not Hillary Clinton at the helm. We would be looking more and more like Sweden in the next 4 years if we don't do something drastic. So I say that because, guess what? I love refugees. I love immigrants. I write for them. I speak for them. I write books for them. These refugees are not like those in Sweden and in many places of the world that rape and plunder. These are decent people that assimilate to their culture and want to make a difference in the society. My good friend Maral, who I'm about to write her book in just a couple of weeks, is assimilating well in Germany. She's learning the language so she can get a job, and she is very, very happy to be there. Well, she is one in many that really assimilate. There are those like you saw in Sweden and heard in Sweden that want to set up their own society and establish Sharia law and take over. These are the non-assimilators, and they are dangerous. So in just a few words, I hope that has helped you with this issue. This is not about racism. This is not about Islamophobia. This is not about refugees. It's about our national security. And if we don't take steps to do something about it, look at Europe. You think, well, that's just Europe. Oh, no. They're here. They want to do the same thing here. They want to take over our country. You think I'm kidding? Robert Spencer had a survey about a few years back where he went to individual mosques and asked just one question. What do you prefer, the Constitution or Sharia law, if you had a choice? 80% of those imams in the mosques throughout the United States, 80% said, we prefer Sharia law over the Constitution. So you think, oh, this is all just hysteria? And you think, oh, this is just some kind of conspiracy? Robert Spencer has done his job. He's a prolific author. He's written very critically of Islam and terrorism. He knows what he's talking about, and he's got the facts to support what he's saying. So this can be us if we don't have a government and a president that says, yes, this is what I'm going to do because I love my country. I want to just give you a few words about my new book that I'm about to finish sometime this week. It is a very different novel compared to all the other novels about Islam, Iran, human rights, etc. This is a Christian worldview novel. It's called Full Moon Over Loch Ness. Let me just give you a brief description about it. In my friend pool on Facebook, I have a lot of Iranian friends, and some of them are atheists. And I guess you could imagine why they are living in Iran like they did at one time. I've always wanted to be able to speak to them, not just on the issues of human rights, but about the existence of God. You know, there's a lot of people skeptical about that after they read books from Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Sam Little and the rest of them. But there are good reasons to believe that there is a God. So my book is a little different. It's a Christian worldview book. It has three principal characters. And this is not a joke, okay? This is true. The three characters in my book, the principal ones, is a serial killer, an atheist, and a Christian. I know that sounds like a joke, but seriously, it's not. I want to talk to some atheists out there. My atheist character is not ornery. He's not offensive like some atheists are. They're so bulldogish. He's pretty straightforward, but he's nice. You can get along with him. You can talk to him. My other character, a serial killer, is horrible. This takes place in Loch Ness. You say, Randy, what on earth has Loch Ness got to do with a serial killer, an atheist, and a Christian? Well, I've always been intrigued as a writer about the so-called Loch Ness Monster. And I thought, well, if I'm going to talk to people about the existence of God, it can sometimes be dry, apologetically, not very interesting. So I'm going to put it in a very important setting, in Scotland, a beautiful place, with this mystery and intrigue of Loch Ness. And so I'm not going to tell you a whole lot more, but that's kind of the basic overview of the book. And so I hope you'll like it. I think if everything works out right, it should be available sometime about March 15th in Kindle and then in paperback a few days later. So thank you so much for reading my books, and I hope you'll like this one. It's absolutely different. And right after this book, in just a couple of weeks, I'll be writing Moral's story. I love to keep busy. I love to write. It's who I am. Right now I want to feature a song from a group from 30 years ago or more, a very good Christian band. They were strong discipleship Christians. They had something called the Highway Missionary Society in Oregon, where they lived on the land, and they had many Christians come there from various different backgrounds, various different lots in life. And they had a lot of good songs. And so I'm going to feature a song before I do my Bible teaching from a group called Servant. This is a song called Come Jesus Come right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
So many tears and reasons.
Wow, the incredible vocals of Sandy Brock, Sandy and Owen Brock, the principal founders of Servant. And I thought I saw something on Facebook just this past weekend that they were doing some kind of a reunion. And that's, wow, that's 34 years ago. That was from a CD called World of Sand. And that's Servant, Come Jesus Come. What, I'd love to see them again. I would go in an instant. They have incredible gifts to share with us, and one of their strongest gifts is music. And they have a way of really writing their songs in a way that really reflects the Christian worldview. I so appreciate them. Well, speaking of the Christian worldview, for the past several episodes, if you've been following The Cross in the Desert, you know I'm doing an in-depth teaching from Matthew chapter 5, which is known in the Bible, Matthew chapter 5, verses 7, as the famous Sermon on the Mount by Jesus. We're studying from Matthew's perspective. Matthew presents Jesus as the king. He shows in chapter 1 the genealogy of Christ, the promised Messiah. He shows in chapter 2 his miraculous virgin birth in Bethlehem. And Matthew has a way of presenting that side of Christ, linking him to as the promised king redeemer. When you come to Mark, it's an action-packed gospel. Mark presents Jesus as the miraculous Son of God, doing miracles to attest to his deity. When you come to Luke, Luke is a historian. So he's presenting the perfect man to the Greek audience, the perfect human being. And that is Jesus, the humanity of Christ. You will see that as you read Luke. It's famous for its many parables. When you come to the Gospel of John, the later gospel, you see Jesus as the great I am. He is God manifested in the flesh. So the four gospel writers paint a wonderful portrait of who Christ is. And oh, by the way, the so-called lost gospels of the Da Vinci Code are not factual. They're fallacious. They're later. They're pseudo. They're false. They corrupt the true teachings of who Jesus is. So don't buy into that stuff. Dan Brown's a great gifted writer. Yeah, you read his novels that are action-packed. This man knows how to describe things and paint well with words, but when it comes to history and theology, particularly Christian history and theology, he's completely out to lunch. It's wrong. Don't buy it. You know, that's how the lie is packaged. It always looks and sounds so good, but it's filled with enough poison, 1%, that will kill you. So what I want to do right now, I want to focus in on what I've been teaching you for the past several episodes on the Beatitudes. The life-transforming words of Jesus, they are life-transforming. They penetrate to the core of our being. And here in Matthew 5, the king is going to sit down on the Mount of Olives and instruct you and me about kingdom living. Since he's the king, he has a kingdom. And if we're kingdom citizens, we need to know how to live the principles, kingdom citizens. You see, Jesus, who is God, when he came here, he lived among us as a servant, even though he's really a king. He took off his robes of righteousness or laid them aside voluntarily. He set aside his rights and his privileges as king in order to be the perfect servant and die on the cross to forgive our sins. And so in Matthew chapter 5, we are greeted with one of the most incredible sermons ever preached that any ear has ever heard in the history of mankind. It's the Sermon on the Mount. I'm reading from Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 11 in the English Standard Version, if you're following me in your Bible. Matthew 5, seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. I want to go over what we've been learning from this incredible teaching called the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. The first way we recognize our need for God's grace, Jesus says, is when we recognize our spiritual condition, our spiritual bankruptcy. They were like beggars at the king's table asking for crumbs to fall down, and that's true. Blessed are the poor in spirit, Jesus teaches. When you recognize that, the kingdom is yours to possess. And for those that recognize their spiritual bankruptcy, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. What does that mean? If we recognize our spiritual poverty, we need God's grace, and we mourn over our sinful condition, mourn, lament, that we cry out to God, like David did in Psalm 51, create in me, O God, a clean heart. Renew a right spirit within me. When we are those that mourn over our sin, Jesus promises we shall be comforted. Now, those that are poor in spirit and mourn over their sin are also meek. Blessed are the meek. They shall inherit the earth. Meek doesn't mean you're a doormat for people to walk over. Actually, it means that you're humble and teachable, just like Christ was. And because of that, you're going to inherit the earth. And blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They shall be satisfied. Well, if you're poor in spirit, you mourn over your sin, you're teachable, humble, and you hunger continually and thirst for God's righteousness in your life, God says, Jesus says, you will be satisfied. And blessed are they that are merciful. They shall receive mercy. When you have compassion, you put your lives on the line for the hurting and broken, you shall receive mercy. You know, when Jesus taught these words to the culture around him in the first century, there were the religious leaders always there to test him, to try to disprove him. The religious leaders, the scribes and the Pharisees, prided themselves in their religion. In their outward appearance, they appeared so righteous, so pious, so holy. And Jesus here in the Beatitudes is getting at our heart. He is striking the curve, the Gordian knot of our heart, because he says here to that same crowd, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Well, wait a minute. That's the very problem Jesus was dealing with. The external false religion of the scribes and the Pharisee, they paraded themselves with an outward conformity to God's law. But the problem, as Jesus is talking about here, is the heart. The Bible says the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can cure it? Jesus says, problem. Your outward conformity to my law is a facade, but the one who is really blessed is the pure in heart. The first thing we learn from this beatitude is that Jesus is concerned with our heart. It's not enough to clean up the act on the outside. Oh, that's what religion really is. Okay, God, I'll change. But you don't have a change of heart. Jesus would later say in Matthew 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and of the plate, but inside they are full of extortion and rapacity. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, and then the outside may also be clean. Oh, Jesus rebuked this kind of hypocrisy. What Jesus is not trying to do here with these Beatitudes is to somehow reform society. He is saying these life-transforming words. He's teaching us these truths to change our hearts. Remember when Jesus said, "You have heard, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in the heart." Well, that's the problem. It's not enough to just conform to the law outwardly. Jesus is saying, look, the problem is not that. You got a heart of lust, and that's what needs to change. You know, that's where our secret thoughts are kept, right? Our feelings. But God knows our heart. He knows the invisible root, and that matters so much to God. The root matters more than the branch. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. 1 Samuel 16:7. Why? Well, from the heart are the issues of life. And these are the things that defile a man, not whether he cleans the cup and the plate. Here's the issues that defile us. Jesus says what comes out of the mouth proceeds from your heart. For out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murder, adultery, fornication, theft, false witness, slanders. That's the problem, Jesus says. That's what defiles the man. So the heart is absolutely crucial to Jesus. These are the deep, private resources of our lives that he cares about. Jesus didn't come into the world simply to change our bad habits that need to be restored, reformed, you know. He came into the world because we have such dirty hearts that need to be purified. So as we look at this beatitude today, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. We want to ask three questions. What does it mean to say we shall see God? What does it mean to be pure in heart? And how are these two things bound together? The first question, what is it to see God? Well, first of all, we learn that seeing God means to be admitted into his presence. When Pharaoh was confronting Moses in the book of Exodus about the number of plagues that were going on, he told Moses, "Get away from me. Take heed to yourself. Never see my face again. For in the day you see my face, you shall die." And Moses said to the Pharaoh, "As you say, I will not see your face again." Exodus chapter 10. Well, King says, "You will never see my face again." What he means is, I will never grant you admission again into my presence. The same way if you have a doctor's appointment. Can I see Dr. Lundgren today? You don't mean, can I see him from a distance? Or can I see a picture of him? What you're saying is, can I have an appointment with him? So the first thing we learn, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, is that seeing God means being admitted into his presence. And we know that only way we're admitted is trusting alone in Christ. The second thing, what it means to see God, means to be awestruck by his glory, to have a direct experience of his holiness. Job, in the book of Job, said, "I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." We are seeing a mediated form of God in this life. We see images and reflections of his glory. We hear echoes and reverberations of his voice. But there's coming a day when God himself will dwell among us. His glory will no longer be inferred from lightning and mountains and roaring seas and constellation of stars. Instead, we will have a direct experience of him. Revelation 21 says, "He will wipe the tears from our eyes. There will be no more sorrow or pain or mourning or crying. We will see him face to face." So to see God in this life means to be admitted into his presence through the new birth, to be awestruck by his glory, just his presence in the world. But also it means to be comforted by his grace. In this life, we don't see him, if you will, face to face in a direct experience. We will in glory. And might I add, we will not see the essence of who God is, because it would disintegrate us. But we will see him in the way he is meant for us to see him, perfectly, directly in heaven. But in this life, we're comforted by grace. In that way, we see God. The psalmist in Psalm 27 says, "Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud. Be gracious to me and answer me. Hide not thy face from me." That means be gracious to me. That means seeing the face of God is a sweet, comforting experience. If God shows his face by his grace, we are helped. But if he turns his face away, his presence away, we are dismayed. So when Jesus promises the reward of seeing God, these three things are applied. We are admitted into his presence. We're not just in the waiting room. We are awestruck with a direct experience of his glory, and we're helped and comforted by his grace. This we have in part right now in this life, but fully in the age to come, if we are pure in heart. Well, what does it mean to be pure in heart? I thought our hearts were deceitful and sinful. They are. Psalm 24 is a great answer to this question. David writes, "Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, he who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully." Do I have clean hands and a pure heart? Do you? Wow. A pure heart in this context has nothing to do with falsehood or lying. It runs from deceitfulness. Deceit is what you do when you have a divided loyalty. You will do one thing and you will do something else. You will be a hypocrite. So the Bible says clean hands and a pure heart. James chapter 4, verse 8, "Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you men of double mind." So you see a reference here in Psalm 24 and James 4, 8. It's referring to clean hands and a pure heart as a preparation for drawing near to God or ascending his hill. And we are told we need to purify our hearts. Again, James writes in James chapter 4, verse 4, "Unfaithful creatures, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." So this man is a double-minded man. He is disloyal. He has a divided loyalty. So purity of heart is important. Jesus says we are to love the Lord, our God, with all of our heart, our mind, and our soul, and our strength. Well, how do we do that? Well, here's what we don't do. We don't work it up. We don't manufacture it. It's something as a result of God's grace working in our soul, in our mind, that we can draw near to God, that we can cleanse our hands of evil deeds and our mouths of speaking falsehood. And we purify our hearts not by doing good works or good deeds or some kind of reparation or some kind of penance. We are purified in our hearts by the work of God the Holy Spirit through the grace of God in our soul and in our lives. And that only comes from being a child of God. You see, again, don't be like the Pharisees and the scribes who outwardly conform to the law, but inwardly their hearts are evil. We as Christians don't do that. Don't make the error of the Pharisees and the scribes. We come to God mourning in our sin, in our spiritual bankruptcy, and we cry out for his righteousness in our lives, and we are dependent on his grace and his spirit to purify the ugliness of our hearts. The Bible says that in the new birth, he gives us a new heart and a new spirit, but we're still bound in this sinful flesh in this life. So until we get to heaven, we have this struggle between righteousness and unrighteousness and sin and obedience. But we only can purify our hearts when we depend on God's grace and cooperate with the work of His Spirit in our lives. These Beatitudes, as you read them, are very progressive. And as you read them and come down to this verse, you recognize that all of the things that Jesus is teaching us for kingdom living is dependent on a relationship with God through Christ by His grace. And so the pure in heart are those that daily confess their sins, who cry out to God for His mercy and His forgiveness, Him to work in our hearts and minds. And so the way we live our lives is not on the treadmill of religious performance, but it's dependent on who Jesus is and on God's grace. So blessed are you that are pure in heart. You shall see God. Blessed are you that have a real relationship with God through Christ and depend on His Spirit and depend on His grace, that cry out for His hunger and hunger for His thirst and righteousness, that mourn over your sin, that recognize your need for grace, that you're spiritually bankrupt. This is the position that we as Christians should take every day. We are relying on His grace and on His work in our hearts and minds to be the pure of heart, to speak His truth, to live in a way that honors and pleases Him. Beloved, don't make the mistake of the Pharisees and the scribes and clean up the outside. Clean up the inside. Cry out to Him for mercy, for forgiveness. Cry out like David did, "Create in me, O Lord, a clean heart. Renew a right spirit within me." When you do that, Jesus says you are blessed. You're the pure in heart. And you shall see God in His fullness one day because you have a relationship with me. I really hope that you have benefited today from these teachings on the Sermon on the Mount. Thank you so much, Sony, for spending some time with me today. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you, my dear friend. Thank you, everyone. I want you to have an incredible week, and I will see you once again on the cross in the desert this Thursday. God bless you. Have a fantastic week.
Oh, glory, glory.